Okay, well, great. So, all right. So, my talk combines a lot of Seth and Fred and Michael's concepts. And what we're really trying to do here is that we're trying to bridge the knowledge and the knowing and doing gap. So, there's knowledge out there about, you know, whether we wanted to screen patients who are at risk, but we're not really screening. And the hypothesis there is that can decision support be leveraged to actually improve the screening? And the answer is yes. So, if you that's the only point that you need to remember for this slide, for this talk. So, St. Louis Children's Hospital, we're an academic institution. We're best of breed, lots of EMRs in our shop, federated ID support. And I lead the pediatric computing facility where we develop widgets for the EMR, helping our clinicians improve their workflow in the EMR if the EMR is falling behind in terms of their implementation. So my objective today is to actually point the fact that patient-generated data can be used as a clinical decision support and actually can be useful for improving rates. If you remember Seth's point earlier, the first speaker, where you look at the little black book, and that's what we're trying to get to achieve, to augment existing clinical workflow, the way we document patient documentation and augment that with patient-generated data. We'll share with you the study that we've done. This is the earliest stage of this of what we're trying to do at Children's, to use a decision support using patient-generated data, share with you the results and what we're going to try to do next. So a few points on patient-generated health data. So it's the health data created and recorded and gathered directly from patients. Or for pediatrics, you know, for custodians and caregivers. It includes health and treatment history, biometric data, things in the smartphone can be used there as well. And it's really distinct from what we do as clinicians, you know, how you interview the patient and we enter the data into the EMR. They're actually entering the data on their own. And what's really important here is that they have the ability to decide how they might share their data, which is really crucial. So it supplements existing gaps that we have in the clinics. It leverages health IT tools, and because of our EMR adoption rate, although it's going up, it's probably still, at its infancy. There's a lot of barriers, and it's really an opportunity to use as a clinical decision support tool. So St. Louis, we're known for the Cardinals, go Cards, yeah. The Arch and the Academic Medical Center is right there, but not so well known. So chlamydia and gonorrhea, are the most common reported and notifiable infections in the U.S., and unfortunately, as city of St. Louis, we are, by far bypassing all the stats. So for chlamydia, we're very high compared to our state in the U.S., as well as for gonorrhea. So we're not that proud of that. In the age group in our city of St. Louis, the teens and the young adults are at risk for chlamydia and gonorrhea. And within the catchment area for our hospital, there are increased rates in that, and we feel that we really need to do something about it. As you know, many of the infections are asymptomatic, and if left untreated, it can cause a lot of problems for our young patients. And CDC does recommend that we test periodic basis, particularly for the youth. And the most important thing is how do you actually follow them up, as they get treated and follow them over time. So at our hospital, we have a opt-out testing for HIV. We embedded chlamydia and gonorrhea testing, screening in our workflow. We've integrated that process in our ED nursing workflow as well, in addition to the clinicians. However, over the past several years, we've noted that our rates have been decreasing. So if you could see that at the far end right there, we're sort of coming down in terms of our opportunities to care for them. So that left us with an opportunity to do that. You know, can we actually test that in our ED? You know, can we develop a clinical decision support tool that actually might improve the rates? And the ED is a perfect venue for it. There are some challenges in there. And how we envision it is we envision it with the idea of the young adults. You know, they're very savvy with technology. And we've implemented this decision support, this audio-enhanced, computer-assisted interview, CASI for short, but I'll show you what that means, how that looks later. And then we've integrated it into the regular EMR workflow or in the ER workflow. So the study involves a computerized questionnaire, but instead of, you know, questionnaire by the care provider, it's questionnaire for the adolescent. We targeted 15 to 21 years old patients that were seen in the ED. And there are some testing recommendations provided by the software, which was provided to the clinician. And we've integrated that in our EMR, and our EMR is WellSoft in the ED. Again, it prompts as a decision support for the doctors and the nurses, and the whole process is confidential for the patient. All right, so this is how it looks for us. This is a dashboard of our ED. The first step, if you know, in the ED, you have to choose the patients that you go, the room that you want to go. When you choose the patient, you click on the patient's name, and in that space, we have a color coding there, and that's how we notify that there's something that you need to know about that patient. And hence, you know, prompting you to look further at what the opportunities for care would be. Patients in the ED, during the pilot program, we've identified them in the waiting room, and the research assistants are the one filling this out. If they are eligible, they enroll into our study, and then they can start with their survey. So we provided them with laptops and tablets. So here, it tells the adolescent or the patient about the opportunity for testing and why it's important for them. They can actually click that, and they have headphones with it. They could listen to it as well. We actually explicitly share with them how they will be able to be contacted given the opportunity for treatment and whether they agree or enroll in the study. All right. So the test questions are very, very explicit. Let's see, go back here. These are the demographics, and we drill in into very specific history about their sexual history. And our tool embeds a sort of like an exploding algorithm. So if you've picked one, you know, a variable, and it, you know, data supporting questions, ran out of battery here, would pop up as well. In addition to that, if they miss out on filling a data point, we would prompt them to answer it, however they could bypass it if they wish. Most importantly, we've actually asked them about the survey itself, whether it's useful or not, so we can tweak them moving forward. So very specific questions regarding the usability of the tool. This one right here is the recommendation that we've shared with them, whether they would have had the opportunity to be tested or not. And then more importantly, give us explicit contact information so that we can contact them in the event that we need to do that for them. So once that's done, the software calculates and produces a report for the clinician to see. And this is the information. It's pretty lengthy, but what I'm trying to point out that, you know, when we talk about the knowing and doing gap, clinicians need to have targeted information that this patient meets the criteria for testing, and that the patient is willing to be tested, and these are the specific variables why they need to be tested. And then the guidelines from the CDC, and then the contact information right down there. So the results. So I'm going to run through two or three of these slides. It's not very important for you to learn, to read the whole thing, but, The average age is about 17, 60% female, 60% African American, mostly Medicaid population. The thing there is that most of them, let's see what, chief complaint not indicative of STI, so about 80% of them. So this is really the reason why we need the screening, because not all of them are symptomatic, and we all know that. Again, I'm going to brush through this. Let's focus on group one for females, group one for males. So of the participants in their study, for females, 50% of them we recommended testing. Out of that, 56% received the testing, and out of that, 7%, 19% tested positive for gonorrhea, and that's how you would read the slide. You know, for males, for instance, in group one, 50% received recommendation for testing, about 50% received the testing, about 3% and 11% respectively for chlamydia, gonorrhea and chlamydia tested positive for them. For those, and this is the fascinating thing for me, one slide right here, is that for those that participants that did not have any chief complaints of the STI, you know, fairly similar rates with those that, you know, in the general population. So, you know, for those who we recommend testing, about 50% received testing, recommended testing, 40% received the testing, and gonorrhea and chlamydia, 5% and 19%, and likewise for the male. So this summarizes our results. So we did 9 months of study of the intervention. We enrolled 800 patients. About half of them received recommendation for testing, and half of that actually received the testing, and about 20% tested positive for chlamydia and gonorrhea. And of those, 55% of them are asymptomatic. And most of the patients that we've asked to do the survey rated the survey being high as its usability. So this is the money slide right here. Before the study, during the study, after the study, before the study, during the study, bump up, and then below. So that it is effective, our intervention was effective. And this is another slide right here, the money slide. For those that have participated during in our intervention, we've tested 33% of them of the eligible patients, whereas for those that did not participate in the survey, about 11% only to testing. So the received the testing. So which means that, you know, using decision support does improve our testing ratio, about tripled our rates at that. So limitations of our study: we rely on the patient. We don't know whether the patient's truthful or not, or can recall a lot of the specific variables that we wanted to know. We also rely on the physician to actually do it, provide a recommendation. The EMR, so we developed the module itself, and it's not the default function of the EMR. So the conclusion is that it can happen. You know, it can be done with the right amount of tools. We could increase our rate, so there's a future for that. And that if you use patient-generated data, the black book that Seth was pointing about, that they are very willing to use that as part of their healthcare delivery or experience. Having said that, I'd like so the next steps. Okay, so we're really going to be this first part. We're going to build a more robust tool moving forward. Integrate labs into our software, integrate it into our EMR, and built it into the EMR module. So this is my last slide. I'd like to thank Dr. Fadamad, who actually led the study in our emergency department, and for the computing facility for actually building the widget. That's all. Thank you.
Hi, I'm going to ask our panelists, our speakers, to come up and form the panel. My name is Susan Blank. I'm from the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene. We just spent some time listening to some pretty interesting presentations. Dr. Foldy had spoken about architecture and plumbing in medical and public health information systems. We learned about clinical decision supports for healthcare providers from Dr. Rockman. From Dr. Klompas, we learned about the use of electronic health data to generate disease reports for health departments and to use anonymized data that are warehoused to do some surveillance of that can include cases and non-cases, which is a bit of a holy grail for public health, so that we could move forward with large population-level assurance activities. And from Dr. Yu, we heard an example of an EMR app, actually, I guess, a widget, right, that includes a sexual history that's patient-sourced that will identify patients for testing, provide some educational opportunities for those patients so that the patients themselves then volunteer or accept testing. And so that's a pretty interesting continuum of questions. Presentations. I'm going to invite questions from the audience. I ask that you identify yourselves and where you're from, and if you know which presenter you wish to address it to, go right ahead and say so. Thanks.
Hi, my name is Gail Burstein. I'm from Erie County in Western New York. I have a question for Dr. Yu, and I really enjoyed your presentation. We've been thinking very seriously of doing something similar in our emergency department, but I think what we're concerns are for those adolescent patients who have a commercial health plan, the explanation of benefits or some type of lab bill, or high parents with high deductible plans, which is more the norm now in commercial health plans, will come back to bite the confidentiality of that visit. And so I was wondering how you address that challenge.
Yes, we did realize that, and it's hard to read because the first few pages explains that might be a risk if they wish that they would, because we don't have any control over that communication. So there may be some that actually opted out because of that risk, but we didn't ask specifically target that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Good morning. I'm Robin Hennessy from New York City, and my question is for Dr. Klompas. So New York City is starting to embark on electronic health reporting, and I know just a little bit of information to make me dangerous. What I'm wondering is how you got the information from the EHRs into your ESPNet. Was it CCDs? Did you spend a lot of time coming up with architecture and et cetera?
Great question. So we actually have a number of methods you can get the data from the source EHR into ESP. The easiest one that we kind of prefer is just a straight extract, transform, and load of character-limited files. And so that's sort of our default. We can also accept HL7 messages, and so we had an installation at a health information exchange in Western Mass in which HL7s was the way that the practices were sending information to health exchange anyway, so we just kind of gleaned the information from that. We have a third system that does a unique extract from Clarity, which is the reporting system associated with Epic. So we actually don't care what kind of format you want to send the information over in. We try to be flexible with that. And the way we've been able to deal with that is that ESP really is built up with three different kinds of modules. There's a module for incoming data, a module for disease detection, and a module for reporting. And each of those modules can be exchanged with one that's more appropriate to either on the receiving end, the kinds of generating system, and on the sending end, the preferences of the health department, because we have two different health departments we work with.
And how much work was it for the EHR folks to agree to be involved? Because that certainly is one of the considerations that we have in getting buy-in from those folks, is how much work is it going to be for them?
Yeah. So the way you phrase the question, how much work would it take them to agree, as opposed to how much work would it take them to actually generate the extracts, is is quite prescient, of course, because that is the bigger part of the burden, is the clinical agreement to participation rather than the actual technical lift of sending data over. So it's based upon relationships and conversations and trying to be very respectful to their concerns, which is primarily simply security, not wanting to release any information these days of concerns about government-based surveillance. So number one would be against security, and number two is allowing them for an incremental kind of approach, where if they're only comfortable doing this much at first, okay, we'll do that, and we'll try to build confidence and go thereafter. So an example of that was when we first set up our systems with each of our practices, although ESP is capable of doing fully automated SCD case reporting, each of our practices first chose to have a step for human review of every case prior to electronic reporting before, in order to gain confidence. And so we have a workflow manager built into ESP where they can do that. And after a time, they say, well, listen, the system works. It does as promised. And so therefore, after a time, they switch it over to automatic. But having that flexibility to respect people, to allow them to truly own the system and be able to see that they can access, turn off the access to the system, reprogram themselves, block the firewalls, etc., whenever they want, allows for that trust building that ultimately allows information to flow.
And the last question, any interest in visiting New York anytime soon?
Sure, I'd love to.
I'm sorry, we're going to have to end because they need to break down the room for the next session. But thank you for all your questions.
Can you guys stay for a few minutes? Okay.